Hey, 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 everyone. Welcome back to the show, Lead Singer Syndrome. That's right. That's my podcast. And I am your host, Shane Told, as I bring you into the backstage conversations that I have with other front men and front women of bands from all different walks of life, all different places, all different genres. But a band today that is near and dear to my heart, and that is Enter Shikari. Rao Reynolds, lead singer, producer, keyboardist. He does a lot. He does a lot. Wears a lot of hats, that's for sure, for this band. He is joining me today, and this is a great conversation. I mean, just the intelligence this guy has and everything that he does, and he's so well-spoken, and he is just someone I look up to so much. And man, did they ever turn some heads with this new album, A Kiss for the Whole World, which came out about 3 months ago. It's a banger. You know when a band puts out an album and you're like, oh, they're never going to top that? Well, their last record, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, I mean, number two on the charts, I was like, oh, they're never going to top this. Well, they did, not just in the chart position, because this new record was number one, but this record is just so good. I enjoy it so much. So this is an absolute treat to have Rao back on the show. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. If you want to get in touch, you can. Hit me up, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. I read my emails. I write back to you, plenty of them. I'll say plenty, not all, plenty. So hit me up. Let me know whatever it is. If you've got suggestions for me, suggestions for guests for the show, whatever it is, hit me up. I read them all. And if you want to join the All Access Club, that really helps me out because it's monetary help. That's what I'm trying to say. And for as little as $6 a month, that gets you in bonus content, merchandise, and more. And if you enjoy this thing, please keep listening. It will always be free, but we do rely on the graciousness of people to join the All Access Club. It is at leadsingersyndrome.com/all-access. That gets you in for $6 a month. All right. Well, I don't have too much else to tell you. I think by the time this airs, I'll already have done the punk rock museum tours. So, but if not, if it hasn't aired yet, then I'm doing them August 4th, 5th, and 6th in Las Vegas. Get your tickets at punkrockmuseum.com and get your tickets for the upcoming Silverstein tour as well, playing This Is How the Wind Shifts in full at silversteinmusic.com. Those are my plugs. But let's get into it. Here is my conversation, and a good one, with Rao Reynolds of Enter Shikari. Meanwhile, back at the Dreamers Hotel, 5 stars, but all rooms are vacant. Meanwhile, I can hear alarm bells outside, they're losing their patience. Meanwhile, back at the Dreamers Hotel, 5 stars, but all rooms are vacant. Meanwhile, I can hear alarm bells outside, they're losing their patience. Rao.
Yo.
Hey, there he is. What's up, man?
How you doing?
Dude, I'm fantastic, man. I'm just going to use audio if that's okay.
Oh, okay, cool.
You know,
shall I switch my video off? I mean,
if you want to leave it on. You look like you're having a lovely morning there. Is that some coffee? Oh, no, it's not afternoon for you. What am I talking about?
Yeah.
I'm on the west coast of the US now, so it's like the time difference is kind of real.
Right. Okay, so what? So is it morning for you?
Yeah, 9 in the morning.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, bright and early.
Yeah, I don't know. Ever since I moved out here to the West Coast, I get up way earlier.
Okay.
I feel like everybody does, and I think it's just because so much of what the rest of the world is doing is on the East Coast of America or out your way.
Right, I see.
So it's like you have to get up. If you don't get up early, you miss everything.
Right. Yeah.
Absolutely, man. Well, how's things with you? It's been about 3 years, I think, since we last spoke. I know a lot's happened, but how's your summer going?
3 years. Well, good. We've just come off the road for a bit. We had a pretty intense first 6 months of the year, really. And now we've got like, we're a couple of weeks into sort of 6 weeks off the road. So
yeah,
been really nice. I've just been, doing some hiking and getting out into the middle of nowhere and,
nice.
Forgetting about everything, really.
Nice. Well, I love that. I mean, congrats on the new record, A Kiss for the Whole World, which is about 3 months old now. And a number one album, dude. I mean, I know you've done a lot of things in your career. I know you put out all these great records and done all this stuff and these big shows. But I mean, I always talk about like the accolades that, you know, like your parents will brag about. I mean, a number one album is about as big as it gets, right?
Yeah. I mean, it still means a surprising amount, I think, to a lot of people, like, especially what's kind of most surprising is outside of the UK. A UK number one album seems to, like, I don't know, it makes people's heads turn a bit more than any other kind of accolade you can speak of, you know, whether it's an award or
right.
a certain amount of followers or, you know, something. It still sort of sparks an interest. But, you know, we've come close. We've had like two number twos.
Yeah.
So the last
album was number like, two, I remember.
Yeah. So it was really nice to just like to clinch this. And it was very close. There was a lot of amazing albums out at the same time. So yeah, it just made us feel very thankful for our audience, really. You know, they're still like super enthused enough to actually buy music, to buy records, which is still something that's kind of, you know, not exactly something that's growing in our society. So it's great.
It's been such a weird last few years. And I kind of only bring it up because the last time we spoke 3 years ago was like kind of right as it was getting going. I think it was around April of 2020 and you were just kind of holed up with your cat, as I recall.
Right. Yeah.
And you'd put out Nothing Is True and Everything Is Possible. And that record's fantastic. And you kind of were like, okay, now what do we do? But with this album, it's kind of like the world is your oyster a little bit, right? Like you can do whatever shows you want. You can, you know, you put out the record in April, you're doing all these festivals this summer and everything else. I mean, was it like almost like weird kind of getting back to that after the last record, especially how well received it was, but to do it like this and play those songs live right away? I mean, that must have been just a different experience.
Yeah, totally. I think we sort of spoiled ourselves. You know, we were like, we almost released it in the most selfish manner, which is, you know, when you write music and you put music out, you want to experience that music live as soon as possible. Because I feel like that's where, you know, any art form really, you don't truly know it until you see it in other people's hands, until you see people reacting to it in a physical space. And the music kind of, it really grows into itself there. And so we just totally spoiled ourselves this time. We were literally releasing a track every month, like January, February, March.
Yep.
Or no, February, March, April even. And we're just playing shows up and down the UK, like literally as soon as we released a track, we'd play a week of shows. And then the next time we released the track, we did the same thing. And it was just, it was amazing getting to experience the songs, you know, in their final form, how they should be experienced live straight away when our previous experience with the last album was having to wait a year and a half to play the music.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? I saw that you were doing that, doing almost like a residency in various UK towns.
Yeah.
You know, like I see you were at St. Luke's in Glasgow, like what, three times? What was that like? Because, you know, going there in February, coming back in March, coming back in April, you must see a lot of the same people, you know, because obviously, like, I know how those ravenous fans are, especially yours. It's like, what was that like seeing those people, the reactions? Obviously, I'm sure you switched up the set list probably dramatically. But what was that like kind of coming back just so quickly after when it's fresh in your mind?
It was really interesting. Like from the get-go, we wanted to do something different with the touring of this album. And that was just one of the ideas that came up. And we thought that going back in such quick succession would almost be like an experiment, you know, like how would things be different? The set lists were like 25 to 50% different each time. So yeah. not like massively, but like enough to make it feel like a slightly different show. But of course it was in exactly the same venue, which is something that we've never done since, like, I don't know, 2005, when we'd be like coming straight off one tour and then going back onto another tour, perhaps supporting another band and playing exactly the same venues.
Right, exactly. Yeah, for sure.
And you just start to feel like a local band in them cities again, which is really nice. You know, going back, like hanging out, like going to your favorite spots. And it sort of put us in a completely different mindset, I think. And it was just really enjoyable. It started to feel like quite, we were just at home every time we come to this venue once again, you know.
Right, yeah. And it's like, oh, that ramen place was really good down the street. I'm going to go to that one, you know. It's like, it's just weird, you know, how so much of the time, especially with the COVID and the hiatus, it's like you go back to a city and it's like, oh, this is kind of different, you know. Like, some things never change, but some things are different. And that is really interesting. And I like that you guys are switching it up. I mean, even in your statement here on your press release, you said it's hard to do anything interesting with live shows today. So there you go. You did something quite different.
Yeah, it's good. It enabled us to kind of witness how different things can be. Like, there's a lot of drama in subtlety. You know, like we can play the same venue. It's the same four guys on stage. We're playing a lot of the same songs, but the feeling can be so different from night in, night out. You know, if like, depending on what we had for dinner that night can like change the performance in some ways, or depending on whether it's a Friday night and people have perhaps a bit more alcohol in their system, you know, it's all these like subtle, like little things you can change.
It's so true.
And it's just interesting to watch it in kind of an experiment that we haven't really done before in terms of going back to the same place again and again.
I do love that discussion, because I get asked all the time in interviews, and I'm sure you do too, if people are like, oh, what song are you just sick of playing, or like wish you could, you know, never have to play again? And like, my answer is none of them. Like, I mean, and I'm sure it's the same with you. Like, Sorry You're Not a Winner, obviously that song is like still number one on your Spotify, and it's the song, you know, put you on the map and everything else. And in a way, sure, maybe the song itself, maybe at this point you'll take it or leave it, I don't know. But the live, every time it's different, right? Something different happens. It's different people. It's a different dynamic. And that is what makes live shows so incredible.
Yeah. And we like purposefully make like tweak the parameters as well, you know, like, so with Sorry Not a Winner as an example, we pretty much give that a facelift, you know, like a makeover every few years, and like change it up and remix it in some way, and that stops it feeling like, you know, we're just going through the motions. One of my biggest fears is like going on stage and it feeling in my mind like it's an act. Like, I'm having to just like do this without any sense of the emotion that the song that was written, right, that is baked into the songs, you know? That enables it to just still feel fresh and exciting if we're exploring like where this song can go. Cause you know, a song is never really finished. It can just continue being made and remade again and again,
right,
ad infinitum. So, that's something we think about a lot, just like keeping things fresh.
I love it. I love it, man. Well, diving back into this new record, A Kiss for the Whole World, which is now out now, everybody, if you've somehow been living under a rock and you didn't know this record was out. This record is tremendous, but I was very surprised reading about it that you went such a long time without writing in the previous kind of couple years between the last albums. And like, you know, being on tour with you before and seeing you kind of constantly, you know, on your computer, like making beats and just being such a creative person and so prolific too. I was just shocked when I read that. And I know for a person that's like that, that so much of their who they are is built into that, I imagine that must have been very tough for you personally.
Yeah, it was grim. It was one of the most strangest, like, disorientating times of my life, really. And it's interesting, you know, the more that we've all come through that period, the more that I hear that lots of people had a similar experience.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
But yeah, it was, I think for me, just the complete loss of the live arena made me just kind of, it was just a loss of human connection, I think, at the end of the day. And that's something that I perhaps didn't realize so viscerally until this happened, that human connection really is, you know, it's not just some platitude. That really is like a fuel, like a driving fuel behind what Enter Shikari is, and I'm sure behind a lot of art. And it was, yeah, so taking away that kind of access to connect with people through the music we make. Obviously, also, I kind of then lost a sense of identity, because I wasn't even really Ralph from Enter Shikari anymore. Like, once you take away the shows, and then consequently from that, you take away being able to write, you know, Enter Shikari ceases to exist. So it was almost like a trippy time, because I was kind of there, still alive, but watching like the death of my band. One of the most strange periods ever, but it was absolute euphoria to come through it and see the other side. But no, I've never gone like,
right,
I think a month is probably the most I've gone without writing something. And I just had a complete loss of not just desire, but also ability, you know, because I forced myself to sit down. I was like, right, I have to, this is getting silly now, you know, after a few months, I need to write something. And just nothing would come. I think I was so caught up with, especially the first 6 months of the first year, that they were nerve-wracking times. Like, nobody knew what was going on, who to trust.
Yeah.
And it's, you can't be as creative as you'd like to be when you're stressed, like that, you know, that's a matter of biological fact. So I think that was what kicked it off. And then, you know, the anxiety comes in, you know, I'm in my mid-30s now. I was like, oh, is that it? Are my creative years behind me? Is Enter Shikari done forever? You know, there's a whole sort of crisis of identity.
Right. And it can build on itself, right? And it can really get in your head, and you can sit down and you can write a melody or a riff or a lyric that maybe is really good, but sometimes you're just in your own head so much, you're just overthinking everything, right? And you're like, is this good?
Totally.
Should I try to make a song out of this, or like, fuck it. And then it's over. Then you walk away from it, and then you don't know. And it really is tough. I mean, yeah, damn. I mean, I guess my question is, when did it kind of click that you're like, okay, I'm back, baby? Like, how did that happen?
Well, it was...
Did someone help you? Like, was there a friend? Did you have to go somewhere? Or was it just like, you just finally just unlocked something?
I think, well, the turning point was probably, we played the Download Festival pilot here in the UK. So
yeah.
This was basically the first... So there'd been a few test events in venues that the government kind of had sponsored to see if we could bring... effectively national live events back towards the what we were then calling rather hopefully the end of the pandemic. And there were like a few, they went okay, and then they were like, right, we need to do some test outdoor events. And so Download Festival, in conjunction with the health department of the government, basically put on a reduced size festival. So it was like a 10,000 cap. So, you know, still, still big enough to feel like a festival. And we were absolutely overjoyed to be asked to headline it. And that, I think for me, that was, it wasn't like some dramatic turning, like suddenly I was able to write music after playing that show, but it certainly opened the door, you know. It was like, okay, I can wear this suit again. I can, my skin is back, you know, sort of thing.
Well, it gives you a lot of confidence, right? I mean, when you're away from people for that long and you don't, it's weird. You just kind of expect people have forgotten or something. And then it's like, wait a second. Like, you know, cause you can feel pretty worthless. I mean, that's happened to me for sure. Like on the long periods of kind of not doing anything, you know, for sure. I can understand that.
Yeah. Yeah. Just the sense of purpose, I think, was one of the strongest things. It was like, right, okay, we've got this to aim for. So we were like straight into our rehearsal space, and the sense of excitement started to build, and the show itself was just so euphoric. You know, it was the first time anyone there had been sort of up together, let alone like moshing with their mates, or you know singing along to stuff in over a year and a half. So that was it was just jubilant, just proper jubilant.
Nice.
And I think it's one of them shows that I'll probably remember forever. It's just like stuck in my mind. Because again, that was actually the first show that we got to play the Nothing Is True and Everything Is Possible, the tracks that off that album for the first time. So at that point, it was a year and a half. So it was,
yeah,
it was mad.
Crazy.
But to your point about like the sense of self-worth, it's, I think one thing that I've hopefully learned from the pandemic and my experience of those years is like trying to broaden my sense of self-worth and not getting it all from like effectively being Enish Shikari, and trying to sort of get it from places that are perhaps either within me or things that are more sort of subtle or wholesome, you know, like. I think it's become quite clear to me that it's important because like, who knows, I might not always have this creative outlet. People may become disinterested, by the next album. Like, you know, anything can happen really. So,
very doubtful, but I do know what you mean. And I mean, I think it is important to be well-rounded. And I mean, we could have a whole podcast episode about that, about we've been in this band for like, you know, nearly, what, 15, 20 years, whatever it's been, you've been doing this and this has been your entire adult life that is your identity and, you know, and the way that you are seen and how much other stuff in our lives as, you know, because you and I are very similar in that we've been in bands for our whole entire adult lives and we've gained this popularity. And it's like, how much other things in our lives have we put on the back burner, you know, for the sacrifice of this, right? I mean, probably a lot.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's a very like foreign, kind of concept to a lot of people with more, you know, inverted commas, normal sort of vocations. Mm-hmm. The kind of stuff you have to sacrifice, you know, whether it's like family events and friends, and you really have to sort of give everything into it if you want to kind of get anywhere, and especially at the beginning, the first few years, to sort of raise your head above the noise. It takes a lot of dedication, and therefore you other aspects of your life always get put on the back burner.
Yeah, absolutely, man, for sure. And well, that's really, I mean, it's really good that you've, at least we're making progress in some way, right? I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it's like, all right, well, you know, hey, we went through all this shit and it's like, okay, well now at least maybe, you know, there's a little more insight or something good came of it. You know, that's, we can't just be completely negative all the time.
As alluring as that is.
Right, exactly. Well, making this record too, I want to get a little bit into the actual production and stuff regarding it, because you guys are always so interesting with how your band functions, because, you know, obviously you are very capable as a producer, as a songwriter, as a lyricist, as a vocalist, as a musician, as an instrumentalist, all that stuff. So a lot of stuff ends up being your baby, but you always say, you know, Enish Shikari is the four of us. It's always been the four of us, you know. I just wonder how it was like when you go through this period of time, this difficulty. I'm sure your band members all probably really had your back, but they were probably also a little bit scared too. But then you kind of went back to the sort of basics and you actually rented a old farmhouse and you set up a studio in there and you kind of got together and made this record. Also using solar power, which was like the craziest thing I've ever read. It's like, don't you have enough things to worry about? Like, of all the gear going to work? And it's also like, oh, is like the sun, well, the sun's not going to stop, but is the solar panel going to stop? And next thing you know, we don't have a computer working, you know?
Yeah, there was a lot to think about. But the whole experience was just like proper wholesome. I think that almost the main goal from it wasn't to make record an album. It was to reconnect with each other, to feel like a band again. Because apart from those, you know, by that point, the sort of small peppering of shows that we'd been able to play, we were still kind of out of touch with what Enishikari was, out of touch with each other. So we just found this kind of almost decrepit old farmhouse down on the south coast of England, and kind of like, it's like guerrilla tactics, you know, like we built our own temporary studio in there. And yeah, as you say, it was completely off the grid. So it was solar powered, which was one of the boxes we want to tick. We wanted to tick from this album because we'd done a lot in terms of reducing our carbon footprint in the live side of the band, but we never really thought about what we can do with recording, and that was kind of one of the most obvious things we could do. But yeah, like you say, it didn't come without its challenges. You're like, we had to,
sure,
things like we couldn't record guitar and boil the kettle at the same time. There literally had to be like, you know, strict schedules in the day where you could, you know, do this and do that. But that just made it like kind of more fun and made it feel, I don't know, there was, what to call it, like a rawness or like a kind of, I'm not sure what I'd call it, but like the fact that it was just the four of us and our engineer, George, in this house. We were cooking for each other. We were like exercising together. We were, you know, recording this album, and it was just, it was very, like, it took a real turn for simplicity,
right,
and just like focus.
Right.
And that enabled us to feel like a team again, to feel like brothers again. And it was something that I think we'd all missed greatly. So there was a real sense of excitement about the music by that point as well. So as things started to come together, I think just the fact that we're also getting to experience this again and getting to write again and getting to record again, it just had us like, just on the edge of our seat. You know, we were doing silly hours, not because of, we had some deadline to like make. It was more that we were just so excited to get up every day, and I'd miss that so much.
Yeah. No, I mean, you do that kind of a record in the middle of nowhere. There's no distractions, right? I mean, all you're doing is like, you know, eating, sleeping, breathing that record. It's not like you're doing it in the center of London and people are going off and, you know, and going to pubs or clubs or whatever, you know, during the recording process, which happens a lot when you record records in major cities. There's a show in town. It's like, if you're stuck in the south of England off the grid, there's no distractions.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Well, we had to, if we wanted to, if we felt that a distraction was needed, we had to make our own. And you know, we there were like, again, it was like wholesome things. So instead of like, you know, going down the pub or going to a show and drinking a load or whatever, it was, we'd go down to the coast and go for like a run along the beach and then a swim. And it was just like, even though this is March in the UK, so this was cold,
very cold. Yeah.
It was still like, you know, it just felt like a team building sort of experience more than anything. So yeah, it was excellent.
I love it. Going back to basics, doing some simple things here. The record is anything but simple. By the way, this record, I think it's my favorite album you've done. I really like the last
one. Yeah.
I really like the last one as well. But this album has a certain energy to it that I feel the last one didn't. I mean, when you kind of came out of this, I mean, I hate to call it writer's block. That's just kind of a cringy term, but I'll call it that for sake of the conversation. When you got through that, Did you find that your creative process had changed at all with the way that you either thought about writing, arrangements, anything like that? Or did you kind of just something clicked and you went back? Because I don't know, there's a certain different energy to these songs. There's a lot of the, like a lot of the callbacks with this album. Like it almost feels more like a cohesive sort of album, where the last one was very, very diverse, like all over the place, you know, like you even had that freaking song that sounded like it could be on the Star Wars Episode One soundtrack, you know, it was right. And so this was a different energy, but I also think it was maybe a little more for the fans. Although I know you guys will always do what you want to do.
Yeah. I think there wasn't a lot of conscious planning before we started recording. One of the things that seemed to be happening, like naturally, and then once we became conscious of it, became a plan, was to have confidence in like melodies or hooks and just like let them shine and support them. Rather than like throwing a million things at a song and like have it go off in some crazy, you know, swerving from road to road, like going off in a million directions.
Right.
I think that kind of thing I especially struggle with. I don't know whether it's there's a deep down sort of subconscious lack of confidence still, where I keep having to sort of layer ideas upon ideas, or maybe it's just I'm not very good at like stopping and knowing when something doesn't need anything.
Right.
But anyway, you know, it's been a journey, but I feel like this album I kind of hit the nail on the head, I suppose, like with that whole thing a bit better. There's a sort of simplicity, although I don't think that's quite the right word. It's just more of like a self-assurance, I suppose, which gives the album like a togetherness or like a focus,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's the fact that it's such a short album as well. It's our shortest album.
It is. So far, 33 minutes.
It's like a bit, it comes across as perhaps a bit more like palatable without at all being like more, I don't know, like pop,
right,
or something, you know. It still contains all the ingredients of Enshikari. They're just like used more sparingly or more wisely, perhaps. And that's something that, you know, yeah, I have struggled with, and I'm sort of proud of with this album, that we've struck a better balance than before, perhaps.
Yeah, I agree, man. I agree. Well, congrats on that record. And it's always great to have a great album also do well, you know, in terms of charts and all that
stuff.
Sure. So that's really, really great too. So congratulations to you and the whole team.
Thank you, mate.
On that. And you guys have tons of more shows coming up. I think the highlight, probably what you have circled the biggest on your calendar, is in February doing a UK arena tour, which, obviously, congratulations on that. That's incredible. But also, I love that you are giving back to the live music community and giving £1 per ticket to smaller venues in the UK that the venues like my band would play. So, talk to me about how that kind of came about, that idea. And obviously, you're very passionate about that. And I know you have really great relationships with so many of these venues, you know, just from playing them over the years.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it really does feel like a, you know, a family, that circuit. We know so many of the people that run these venues. We work closely with Music Venue Trust, which is an organization here in the UK that just do amazing things where no one has kind of stepped in to help venues. They do such a good amount of support, and, you know, put pressure on the government to various aspects to support these smaller venues. You know, for me, like the major thing was seeing the statistic that we're losing here in the UK. We're losing a venue,
yeah,
every week.
Yeah, I saw that too. It's kind of wild, man.
Yeah, it's unfathomable, and it's just so sad, because of course these are all the venues in, like, mainly in, like, the off the beaten track kind of cities. You know, we're not talking about London, Birmingham, Glasgow. These are places that deserve, you know, live music and live events just as much as any other corner of the British Isles.
Yeah.
And it's just, yeah, it's really tragic. So we wanted to do, you know, the £1 thing is, like, it's obviously great and we're going to raise some money for it. But the kind of reason we wanted to do it was to put pressure on the bigger venues, the arenas and things, for them to do this themselves. So on all the shows that they do. And now Wembley, as a venue, the Wembley Arena, like, talking about, they're in talks with how they can make it work. So it's like started the ball rolling.
Totally.
Which we're super happy with.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, hopefully, you know, this will literally save some venues. It will save some scenes. It will continue to put pressure on the government. It will continue to sort of bring the whole music industry together and help, you know, a route for us all to support each other, which
totally
I think has been sort of lacking, really.
And it really is an investment in the future of music too. And you bring up a really good point about the bigger arenas and stuff. How many, you know, nights a week are those arenas dark? You know, a lot, right? Like, there's a lot of events, but they don't have 365 events a year. But if they did work on the infrastructure of smaller venues and building up the scene and building up bands, well, guess what? Like, the bands that do click, the bands that do start somewhere and build their way up, like, just like Enter Shikari, eventually they will get to arena size, right? Like, doesn't that just make sense as an investment?
Totally. Yeah. And I think that's why we were so confused by the whole thing, because, you know, normally when you speak to, like, people in government or kind of NGOs and things, they often, you know, this is a bit of a, almost like a cliche, they often don't see the importance of something unless you can show them the economic benefit.
Yes.
Which is, you know, we could talk, there's a whole podcast on that about how just sad that is, you know. Something's only real if it's making money.
Right.
But the thing is, so at the moment in the UK, we've got 20 new arenas that are either in the process of being given the go-ahead or they're in the process of being built. Who is going to fill these new arenas by the time they're built in sort of 5, 10, 15 years, when we're losing all these venues and therefore losing all these ways that, like, new artists, young artists,
totally,
niche, interesting, you know, types of music, if they're not given a base and they're not given an opportunity to hone their art, to develop their art, like, there'll be no new superstars, you know, going to be filling the O2 arena in London, you know, whatever the biggest one is, you know. So it makes economic sense just as much as it makes kind of moral sense for me.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely, man. Well, I mean, you got those shows in the UK coming up. Everybody get tickets if you're in the UK in February with Fever 333 supporting. Awesome. You're also doing some big festivals in the US. I see Riot Fest, Furnace Fest.
Mm.
You know, and obviously, you know, the US, it's a territory you guys have toured quite a lot, but you do tour there a little bit less than you did in your younger years. Talk to me about your relationship with the US at this point. Obviously, you know, you still have diehard fans there, but, you know, it's not arena shows. You know, some of the shows are probably only a few hundred people, and some of them might not have a backstage toilet sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
That's the reality. So you talk to me about how that is for you guys when you just, you know, sell out Wembley Arena or something, and then next thing you know, a couple of weeks later, you're in pick a US city and it's like, oh, well, we're not as big here. I mean, that obviously must keep you guys grounded in a way, but also, like, you're still growing in places. Like in Germany, I saw you're playing some of the biggest shows, you guys, maybe the biggest shows you've ever played there. So is there kind of a give and take?
Yeah. I mean, I find the whole thing fascinating, you know, like, especially when we try to work out why we're big in some places and like can't achieve that same momentum in other places. And for us, that there's been all sorts of things throughout our history that have kind of tripped us up or like slowed our momentum in various regions. And the US, I think, has been for us probably the region that's like we've struggled with the most. I think often, you know, when you're doing a full US tour, that's kind of, it can be like 8, 9, even more weeks away from home.
Yeah.
And when you're in the middle of a kind of, well, let's just say a world tour, that period of time away from home completely can like destroy you. So we've had a lot of like problems with it in the past. We've had a lot of problems with Rob, our drummer, not being able to get visas. Oh, yeah. So having to use standard drummers and things.
Yeah.
And it just feels like, I don't know whether it's just bad luck or what, but it's been a struggle. But it's never, well, I will say we have had the conversation about, should we just like not play America anymore, which a lot of our peers actually in the UK that have the same sort of, I don't want to say it's a problem, it's not a problem, but like have the same experience, have kind of just called America quits and just like just concentrated on Europe and Australia, say. But I think every time we go there, even if it is like 100 people in some, you know, the middle of America somewhere, there's a passion there. You know, the people that like get it and appreciate it, like really do. And for me, that is all that, that was all that matters. Like literally.
Totally.
I started writing music, we started this band, was to connect with people. And so like, it sort of, as long as I can carry on doing this, it doesn't really matter how many people I'm connecting with. Because I'm not a person that sort of measures it in, you know, amount or quantity. It's more about just like having those individual connections and appreciating them. And I think that comes from like at its root from like a social anxiety thing. Like because I find it quite hard to immediately connect with people in perhaps more like traditional ways. Music has always been something that like I can easily and like gratefully like connect with people over. It's now sort of like hardwired, you know, in my bones that is why I do this. So in a way I feel like quite lucky then, because we can go and play those smaller places. And where I think this is not to say that I don't feel like this, but a lot of people would then be sort of downheartened. But if you concentrate on those individual connections, you can be just as enthused and excited as playing, you know, an arena in front of 10,000 people.
Totally. No, it's true. I mean, you can have an incredible show, an incredible connection with the audience to 200 people or to 20,000 people. You know, it can be, you can still have that in both facets. And I think that's kind of cool that you get to experience that, you know, sometimes, because, you know, my friend lives in Chicago, and he, you know, did a show for, or was that a show, like a secret show for Papa Roach, playing, I think, at the Bottom Lounge, you know? And it's like a band like that, they never get to do stuff like that. They're too big everywhere.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
They never get to play a show with like, you know, no barricade or something like that. Right. So, you know, those kind of things, it's kind of fun that you can do different things. And I just wonder how much difficulty there is with production planning, right? Because like you're gonna have to do something awesome in February for your fans, you know, in an arena, like with all the lights and all the production and everything else. But then, you know, in other places it's like, okay, well, for this song, like when this chorus hits, like, I'm sorry, there isn't going to be any, you know, fucking confetti or whatever. You know, like the planning of the show, it really changes too, depending on, you know, the kind of venue you're in.
Yeah, mate. I mean, that is the bane of our lives. Like adapting the show to the various levels, you know, from continent to continent, say. We put a lot of work into the shows, and we like work very closely with, you know, we have like this small team, and it becomes very difficult to be constantly like chopping and changing things and working out how we're gonna do the best we can in like a 400 cap venue or whatever. So that's probably one of the most difficult things about our situation. You know, like we're not a band that can just like take the same production around the world and just do a world tour, and it's, yep, you know, they're playing arenas everywhere or something.
Exactly.
That sounds like an absolute dream, at least logistically.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, yeah, I was just gonna say, as you say, like then we wouldn't get to play the sort of sweatier, yeah, no barricade shows,
exactly,
and they can sometimes be the funnest ones. So yeah,
that's right. That's right. Exactly. Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I got just two more questions I want to ask you. You guys care so much. I mean, just about everything. And you guys are so ahead of the curve in terms of what is right. And you've used the word wholesome a lot of times, but you know, just things that you're doing, like recording your record using solar power, you know, or giving away a quid per ticket, you know, to the scene or everything else. You've been doing this a long time. This is part of who you are. Do you feel now, as like veterans of the scene, you look back, you look at some of the younger, newer bands, and I don't really need to name names, but so many of the UK bands, they have the same ethos and the same ethics. And you kind of started that, I feel, it within the scene and within the UK. Do you notice that? And you know, do you kind of think about that as you move forward, and that it's important to keep doing this and kind of just set a really good example, I guess is a good way to say it, you know, for some of the younger artists?
I think it's probably like to an extent, a lot of the inspiration comes from like what's your normality. And I've just been very lucky to have people around me who either work in those areas or care about those things, and I can discuss ideas with and make plans with. Because I remember like growing up in our sort of local scene just outside of London, and one of the things that drew me towards music and live music and being in a band was hardcore punk, and the fact that,
yep,
a lot of those bands were singing with complete conviction and fire about things that actually meant something. You know, I think even by the time I was like 15, I was kind of like done with the subject matter that I was exposed to in terms of like pop music. And you know, I kind of grown up on some great pop music. I had Motown, Northern Soul, Beatles, Queen, you know, everything thrown at me from a young age, and I adored it, and that gave me my love for melody. But like, mm-hmm, it wasn't until I sort of started discovering punk and hardcore, and to a certain extent probably like folk as well,
right,
sure, that I sort of discovered that like, oh wow, music is actually like a quite a powerful force to like kickstart you into, you know, believing and working towards like a better world. And that was immediately, I'm not entirely sure why, but I found that really alluring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think at the same time I was, you know, discovering like Rage Against the Machine and Refused, and you know,
yeah,
when you see the venom that they're giving off on stage, and then you know, as a young music enthusiast, you read the lyrics intently and you try and work out what they're saying. And that's not to say that I had any clue about Zach De La Rocha's politics when I was 15. I didn't know much about South American politics or whatever, but still I was like, whatever he is talking about, I am behind him, you know? And there was like a real allure to the emotion there. And I think that's just how we've kind of, that's how we developed our music. And then it was just a, you know, a small step from then. If we're singing about these things, we want to be like doing what we can as well in terms of action, be that inside or outside the band.
Yeah.
But yeah, as I say, like you can have those sparks of inspiration, but it's having a community around you that I think carries on the momentum and like keeps us kind of focused on these broader goals other than like attaining success, you know, getting a number one album. These things, like, of course they're like amazing, but like if we didn't have all these other goals, that's all we'd have. And I think that's when it becomes dangerous, you know, that's when, if all you care about is getting bigger and playing bigger venues and
right
selling more records, that's for the mental health, that's a dark and risky sort of road to be going down.
Yes, no, the amount of UK bands I've heard discussing, well, where do they play in London? Where do they play in London? Are they an Alley Pally? How many Alley Pallies can they do? You know, it's like, that shit is kind of toxic. Yeah, definitely.
Oh, for sure.
Definitely. So the fact that you're doing this and spreading this importance and this love and just really just, it's a lot of it is charity work. It's really, really, really good. So I like to focus on that, you know, and let people know that you're doing that. And also, you know, hopefully people can help you support all that, you know?
Oh yeah. No, thank you, man. Appreciate it.
Well, Rao, one last question before I let you go. I want to let people know about your book that came out about a year after we last spoke. It's about 2 years old now. I know it was, quote, one of the most arduous and intense projects I've ever undertaken. My question for you, and I know you could probably talk for another 20, 30 minutes about the book, but where do you even start when you write a book? Like, is it anything like making an album? Because I've never written a book. I don't even know what goes into it. Talk to me about that kind of process and what the feedback was like on some of your writing, as opposed to, you know, you hear about the music from people, but what did people think about some of the writing?
Well, I suspect it probably would have been similar to like writing an album if I'd done it properly, shall we say. I basically just started writing what was going to be like a companion guide to the Nothing Is True album. And, you know, I've done this before, where I basically just write a small essay for each song, describing what the motivations were, the inspirations, and the meaning behind the lyrics. And that's what I set out to do with this one. But of course, this was at the start of the pandemic, and the fact that I couldn't write music and I didn't know what else to do, I just found myself writing more and more and more. And I was like, oh, this is quite a long essay now for this song. And then I was like, finding a lot of, I don't know. I think I also like, I remember reading a review of us a couple of years before, and it was criticizing, not so much criticizing our outlook or our politics or anything, but like criticizing the fact that we don't go into any detail on these kind of, in their words, utopian values and kind of directions that we want to see happen in society. And that got me thinking, of course, it was a slightly ridiculous statement to make, because you can only give so much detail in like a 3-minute essentially pop structured song.
Right.
And so I was like, you know what, maybe now is the time for detail. And especially as the world was literally falling apart around me, I was like, I felt really enthused to try and write where I think we're going wrong. And you know, really on a broad scale, look at anthropology, look at sociology, look at the kind of trajectories that we're on. Of course, that, you know, includes climate change and the kind of fossil fuel crisis that we're currently in. And then looking at, you know, everything from AI to you know, all the things that are basically going to change or somewhat influence the direction that humanity is going in. And yeah, so it was a very... kind of just all of a sudden I was like, oh, well, I guess this is a bigger project. So there was no like sitting down like I would at the beginning of an album and trying to go, okay, what do I want to say? What's this going to be about? How long is it going to be? What is there any instrumentation I use differently or whatever? There was no sort of like grand precept to it, like no concept. It was just, it just kind of blossomed and got ridiculous. And I was like, oh, well, I'm actually writing a book now. This isn't just like a companion literature. This is something in its own right. And Yeah, it's, you know, it's gone down really well. Like the thing that I've really liked is when people have read it and they're not even necessarily really a Shikari fan, because I don't think you need to. I think people have got a lot of joy from reading the book, and then, like, you know, a lot. In fact, I just retweeted someone the other week who was saying, like, I find myself listening to the songs and, like, hearing them differently, and, you know, reading a few paragraphs and then going back and listening to the song again and stuff. And I love that. I mean, like, I've always been such a sucker for detail. It's been a joy to hear things like that. But I think when people who aren't even necessarily, like, you know, down or massively interested in our music, the fact that they've got some insight out of it, because, you know, it took... That was months and months of research, let alone before, like, doing the final writing for that book. So it was a lot of work that went into that. So I'm glad that all sorts of people have got something out of it.
There you go. Yes, a treatise on possibility. 288 pages. That's the length of the book. So yes, it did get a little longer than just a track by track, didn't it?
It did indeed. Never again.
Yeah, I know, right? Rao, thank you so much for taking the time, man. Congrats on the new album, number one album, A Kiss for the Whole World, which is out now. Everybody check it out and get some tickets to their shows. They're playing everywhere. I mean, there's shows... US, Europe, UK, lots going on. You can plan out your next almost year with Enter Shikari. So that's amazing, man. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. Are you guys...
Anything else to tell the people?
Well, I was gonna ask if you guys were at any of the festivals that we were doing.
We are at Riot Fest, actually.
Oh, nice.
I think we're playing the Friday. I don't know. I hope it's the same day, but I don't know if it is.
Okay.
I think we're with the Foo Fighters.
I think we're the Saturday, but I know we're going to... The Furnace, yeah, Riot, and I think we're doing one other. They're all brilliant lineups. I think we were... If depending on our side shows, we're going to try and, like, just go to the festivals, even the days we're not playing, because it's... Yeah.
Totally.
Looks sick.
It's really... Yeah, Riot Fest is really great. Furnace Fest, too. They get... These bands, like, I never thought I would even see play.
Yeah.
The bands haven't played shows in like 25 years and they're just back. It's like,
yeah,
incredible. So yeah, enjoy that. It's going to be great. And it's nice to have everything back to, you know, quote unquote normal. And great to see you guys doing so well.
Oh yeah. Thank you, brother.
Anything else to tell the people before I let you go?
I'm good. Stay hydrated, eat your pulses and look after each other.
I love it. All right, I'll leave everybody with a tune. Here is Please Set Me on Fire. New music from Enter Shikari on Lead Singer Syndrome.
Wait for the spark.
Please set me up.
So there is new music from Enter Shikari, Please Set Me on Fire, from the new album, A Kiss for the Whole World, which is out now. 33 minutes and 57 seconds of... It's a great album. I don't know how else to say it. It's hard to describe. It takes a lot of different paths. There's a lot of different stuff on this record. It's terrific. Great songs, though. I think what he was saying about them really focusing on that, like, oh, here's a hook. Why do we need to put so much, you know, layers or so many different things on it when it's like, here's the song. It's a really, really cool record. So check it out. A Kiss for the Whole World. It's out now. And get your Enter Shikari tickets, everybody. Lots of headline shows all over the place. I want to thank Rao for coming on with me again. Just one of the best dudes ever. And thank you for listening to this. And if you like this, please tell a friend, tell a loved one, write a review on iTunes, join the All Access Club, whatever. Help me out and go back and listen to one of the other 300 and something episodes. Hit subscribe, hit follow, whatever the button is that you're listening to this on, that all makes a difference as well. But I really do appreciate you being here and listening to my conversations that I have with other lead singers. That's all for now. We'll see you next week. Peace and love.